Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 994. What was old is new again. This is being recorded on January 30th of the year 2018. Last week in For the Record 993, we began our discussion with yet another very useful article about Ukraine from Consortium News. That is the website that was founded by and edited by Robert Perry, P-A-R-R-Y. This past Saturday, Robert Perry very sadly passed away at the age of 68. He had apparently been suffering from undiagnosed pancreatic cancer for some years and had had several strokes in recent months and was in hospice care. He passed away, and I'm simply going to commemorate his passing by reading a comment that I posted to the article on Consortium News announcing his passing. There will be a link in the description for this program. In that article, or to that article, I posted the following comment. A very, very sad occasion. It was my privilege to have interviewed Robert Perry a number of times over the years, including an interview scheduled days before that took place on the day he learned of Gary Webb's death. It was also my privilege to have used many articles from Consortium News in my weekly broadcasts, including and especially his reportage about the return to power of the OUNB successor organizations in Ukraine. Very few have manifested the courage and integrity to report honestly on those events. Now, there will be fewer. Rest in peace, Robert. Well, that says everything that I could say. Today is January 30th of 2018, and tonight Donald Trump is going to give his first State of the Union address. And I've noted in the past that everyone is talking about how Donald Trump is somehow a different kind of Republican, a break from Republicans of the past. He is more erratic and more vulgar. He also says quite directly what many Republicans have communicated via political dog whistles. Donald Trump is anything but a break from the past. His agenda vis-a-vis corporations and the military are basically the ideological wet dream that the Republican Party has embraced for decades. Trump went to sleep with a copy of My New Order, a compendium of speeches by Adolf Hitler that was a successor volume to Mein Kampf. And I have noted in the past that Trump is simply put, he is definitely a fascist. He is, however, a continuation, albeit a more erratic, more vulgar, and more out front continuation of past Republicans. Exemplifying the political landscape of Donald Trump and, frankly, of the Republicans, and exemplary of the State of the Union is Peter Thiel, last name T-H-I-E-L. Peter Thiel is one of the true titans of tech. He is a profound, very profoundly powerful, very intelligent fascist and tech maven whose influence here in Silicon Valley could not be exaggerated. In discussions of Eddie Snowden, Julian Assange, Glenn Greenwald, and Pierre Omidyar, I have noted that all of them were the exact opposite of what the so-called progressive sector has imagined, that they are, in fact, fascists and reactionaries, and I have compiled a small encyclopedia of documentation to that effect. I have predictably taken a lot of heat about that. I would note simply in that context that I have been warning for many years. I am based here in the Silicon Valley, and I have warned for many years about how the very technological developments, internet, social media, mobile technology that have absolutely transfixed much of the American public are in fact things that compromise their privacy and integrity beyond their understanding. When A.B. Snowden's, quote, disclosures, unquote, came out, they were simply a posit, the things that had been noted for a long time, things that I have spoken about from open sources since roughly 1995, intermittently. One of the programs in which I basically warned that all of these technologies, which in fact are conceived of as liberating, are anything but. They are in fact deeply, deeply constricting. And for the record, 718, in your Facebook, a virtual panopticon recorded on July 4th weekend of 2010, years before Snowden began his operation, I noted that social media such as Facebook and related technologies are seen by people as liberating, and in fact, they are the opposite. Peter Thiel was the focal point of an article in San Francisco Magazine of November 29th of 2017. This is an article by Scott Lucas, L-U-C-A-S, Peter Thiel's Apocalypse, and it reads in part as follows. If press reports are correct, President Trump is considering appointing Thiel to be chair of the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, a position previously held by such establishment sages as Brent Scowcroft and Chuck Hagel, skipping down. Speaking of Osama bin Laden, Peter Thiel has opined, quote, today, mere self-preservation forces all of us to look at the world anew, to think strange new thoughts, and thereby to awaken from that long and very profitable period of intellectual slumber and amnesia that is so misleadingly called the Enlightenment, he writes. Parenthetically, he's opposed to the Enlightenment. Continuing, to explore these, quote, strange new thoughts, unquote, Thiel turns to German legal scholar Carl, C-A-R-L, Schmitt, S-C-H-M-I-T-T, a brilliant thinker who was also a Nazi and the Third Reich's preeminent legal theorist. Once again, a brilliant thinker who was also a Nazi and the Third Reich's preeminent legal theorist. For Thiel, Schmitt is an inspiring throwback to a pre-Enlightenment age who exalts struggle and insists that the discovery of enemies is the foundation of politics. Schmitt was one of the prime generators of what was known as the Conservative Revolution or Conservative Revolution in Germany that gave rise to, among other things, ultimately and philosophically, the Third Reich. I've spoken about that in some of my discussions with, we have spoken about it in some of the discussions I have had with Kevin Coogan, author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki, and the Post-War Fascist International. Back in, for the record, 718, again recorded on July 4th weekend of 2010, I delved into Peter Thiel, noting his background as the son of a chemical engineer from Frankfurt, Germany. That is the seat of what was IG Farben and is now the member companies of IG Farben. His tributaries politically and I guess one could say genealogically run through South Africa, Namibia. He ultimately went to work for a time with Sullivan and Cromwell, the old Dulles law firm. we're going to listen to parts of side two of For the Record 718 from July 4th of 2010, and we're going to hear about Thiel's relationship to not only what I have called the Underground Reich, his profound anti-immigrant stance, his networking with people involved with InQtel, the CIA's venture capital arm here in the Silicon Valley, and his networking with people like Roloff Peek Botha, the grandson of Roloff Peek Botha, one of the prime movers of the late apartheid regime. We're going to wrap up by noting Peter Thiel's profound links to not only Sequoia Capital, but to many other Silicon Valley movers and shakers who, between them, have forged much of the virtual landscape. Now, from For the Record 718.
A few more details about Peter Andreas Thiel, or Thiel. I'm not sure how he pronounces his last name. Now, this is a Bloomberg.com story from December 4th of 2006. It's by Deepak Gopinath, G-O-P-I-N-A-T-H, and it's headlined or titled, PayPal's Thiel scores 230% gain with Soros-style fund. Now, this is the aforementioned Peter Thiel. He was one of the founders of PayPal. More about that later in this broadcast. And he also runs a wildly successful hedge fund called the Clarium Fund. And some more details about Mr. Thiel's background here. And again, I alluded to this in side one. First of all, his background. It's hard to say when Peter Andreas Thiel first decided that one person could outsmart the crowd. Born in Frankfurt, Germany in 1967, Thiel bounced among seven elementary schools from California to Namibia to Ohio to South Africa as his father, Klaus, a chemical engineer, worked around the world. Klaus, his wife Suzanne, Thiel, and Thiel's younger brother Patrick eventually settled in Foster City, California, north of Silicon Valley. And still more about Thiel. After collecting his law degree, Thiel clerked for U.S. Federal Circuit Judge Larry Edmondson in Atlanta and then joined Sullivan and Cromwell LLP in New York. He lasted 7 months and 3 days before quitting out of boredom, he says. He jumped to CS Financial Products, a unit of what's now Credit Suisse Group, where he traded derivatives and currency options for a little more than a year. So he went right after graduating law school, Sullivan and Cromwell, then a branch of what is now Credit Suisse, and still more about his political philosophy. Thiel is a proponent of a geologic theory known as peak oil, which holds that global oil production is now at or near its apex. Among his stock picks was Calgary-based Encana Corporation, which wrings oil from the tar sands of Canada. Encana stock rose 54% in 2005. In a number of programs, numbers For the Record programs 478, 506, 534, and 552, I dealt with various aspects of the peak oil theory and how it ties in with some of the cartel agreements, the old IG Farben and Standard Oil cartel agreements, and how it also links with a very nice sort of touchy-feely, green-coated fascist politics. More about Peter Andreas Thiel. Again, the real driving force behind Facebook and one of three board members. It is mentioned was mentioned in the article with friends like these, the long article with which we began the program, that Thiel was involved with Vanguard.org, a neocon internet-based site. Also, he is involved with a fellow named Robertson Morrow III. And this is from Gawker.com, and specifically, this is from, well, the full annotation will be in the description for this program. This is titled, Billionaire Facebook Investors' Anti-Immigrant Heresy. It's by Owen Thomas, and it reads in part as follows. Insiders at Clarium Capital, the $5.3 billion hedge fund run by Facebook investor Peter Thiel, are buzzing about their boss's $1 million donation to Numbers USA, an anti-immigrant group. The donation is an open secret within Clarium, and it has enraged several staff members who joined Clarium because they believed Teal shared their libertarian ideals. When I asked Teal if he'd made the donation, an underling passed on a non-denial, saying the company didn't comment on gossip and heresy, unquote. A typo, he meant to say hearsay, but a suggestive one at that. Teal has fallen under the sway of Robertson Rob, unquote, Morrow III, a Christian right-wing thinker who has personally donated to Numbers USA and persuaded Teal to make his own much larger donation. Morrow is a controversial figure within Clarium, a hedge fund Teal founded after leaving PayPal, the payments company he co-founded and sold to eBay for $1.5 billion. Morrow was once chief investment officer at the San Francisco-based company, but was pushed out of Teal's inner circle after he had a nervous breakdown on the trading floor. Morrow slowly worked his way back into Teal's good graces and was assigned to run the company's then small New York office. Recently, his influence over Teal and Clarium, and I think by extension perhaps we might say Facebook, has grown. Earlier this year, Morrow wrote a paper called The Bull Market in Politics, unquote. His thesis was that government influence over trade policy, social programs, decisions of war and peace becomes more important, unquote, to investors. One key policy area, immigration, where Morrow thinks there is a rising consensus for restrictions. A politically driven drop in immigration has broad economic implications, especially on the housing market. With less population growth, housing prices will continue to suffer for much longer than most anticipate. But Morrow is not merely forecasting the market. He has cajoled his influential boss to spend money to make his forecast a reality. A Numbers USA spokesman called me to deny that Teal had actually made a donation, but the money trail out of Clarium is clear, insiders say, and it would be a simple matter for Teal to have arranged to make his donation through a third party like Donors Trust, a conservative foundation through which charitable grants can be directed. The reason why Teal would want his donation to be anonymous is simple. Even while he's betting against immigration with his hedge fund, he's making money off immigrant-run startups in Silicon Valley. And so again, in addition to Vanguard.org, note that Numbers USA, a specific anti-immigrant activist group, and is basically another of the causes actively supported by Peter Teal. And note also his association with Robertson Morrow III, a right-wing Christian thinker. Again, one of the things that I noted in the long article with which we began the program was that yet another of the three board members of Facebook, James Breyer, was formerly chairman of the National Venture Capital Association and served on the board of InQtel, a venture capital firm that was actually established by the Central Intelligence Agency in the Silicon Valley. From the Scoop website out of New Zealand, this is the NewZealandHerald.co. There's the following story from Matt Greenop, and this is from August 8th of 2007. It's titled Facebook, the CIA Conspiracy. And skipping down, we read, Facebook's first round of venture capital funding, $500,000 US, came from former PayPal CEO Peter Thiel. Author of an anti-multicultural tome, The Diversity Myth, he is also on the board of radical conservative group Vanguard PAC. The second round of funding into Facebook, $12.7 million US, came from venture capital firm Acel Partners. Its manager, James Breyer, was formerly chairman of the National Venture Capital Association and served on the board with Gilman Louie, CEO of InQtel, a venture capital firm established by the Central Intelligence Agency in 1999. One of the company's key areas of expertise is in, quote, data mining technologies, unquote. Breyer also served on the board of R&D firm BBN Technologies, which was one of those companies responsible for the rise of the Internet. Dr. Anita Jones joined the firm, which included Gilman Louie. She had also served on the NQTEL's board and had been Director of Defense Research and Engineering for the U.S. Department of Defense. She was also an advisor to the Secretary of Defense and overseeing the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, which is responsible for high-tech, high-end development. So again, although I don't view this as quite as alarmingly significant as many really would regard to the development of any new technology, particularly any decisive technology, one is going to find the intelligence community deeply involved with that. However, one of the things that I want to stress is that, again, superficially we see technologies like Facebook as benign, liberating developments, and in fact, they can be used to become very malevolent and enslaving developments as well. And that's something I think we need to bear very carefully in mind. And again, noting that basically an awful lot of personal information becomes available through Facebook once you join it, and it leaves people really quite vulnerable just about anything. At the very least, information is so much of the contemporary commercial landscape. In the past, wars and other struggles for economic control have been waged in order to gain dominance over such resources. And so when we see an organization like Facebook, with the sorts of individuals behind it who are, in fact, behind it, we want to pay very close attention to the men behind the curtain, because those are some very, very, very interesting men indeed. Now, still more about some of the folks behind Facebook. Once again now, the individual who we were talking about earlier, Peter Thiel, also was something of a right-wing activist at Stanford University. And while I would not necessarily, this before his tenures with Sullivan and Cromwell and Credit Suisse, which I do think are significant, it certainly indicates that he was moving along some of the power networks that yielded George Bush and that are inextricably linked with the operations of international fascism over the years. While at Stanford, and in addition to publishing the Stanford Review, he also was very critical of Stanford's curriculum and published a book called The Diversity Myth, Multiculturalism and the Political Intolerance on Campus, that based on his Stanford University experiences. One of the examples of political correctness that Thiel and his co-author Sachs cite in the book involves a law student named Keith Rabois, and I may be mispronouncing this, R-A-B-O-I-S. The offense that Rabois executed basically was the following. In a misguided attempt to assert his freedom of speech, Rabois yelled, quote, "Faggot, faggot, hope you die of AIDS," unquote, outside a lecturer's home. He was hounded out of Stanford, Thiel and Sachs say. Rabois later joined PayPal. Rabois's behavior was offensive and stupid, Thiel says. He says he still thinks that the incident was overblown. The extreme reaction to it was not quite proportionate to what happened, unquote, he says. Well, again, this is his view on something that happened when a fellow was fairly young and then when he was young, but the fact that Peter Thiel undertook to hire this guy at PayPal later, well, I think that's significant. And while one wants to avoid guilt by association at the same time, association by guilt can be something that we want to pay a lot of attention to. And again, I think it is revealing, not necessarily overly significant, but revealing that someone who would go out of his way to be as ripely provocative as Mr. Rabois obviously did, well, that somebody like that would later be hired by Peter Thiel, I think, is indicative of, at the very least, the man's overall sensibilities. And is this really someone you want to have access to all of your most sensitive information? Now, another person with whom Peter Thiel has been networking, and one of a very small number of individuals who have launched in sequential order, but who have launched YouTube, PayPal, they've launched Yelp, and also Facebook now. And this is a fellow named Roelof Botha. He is the grandson of Roelof Peek Botha, a former South African foreign minister. And he is actually, the Peek Botha was a fellow, although he helped to negotiate the release of Nelson Mandela. He was himself an ardent supporter of apartheid. And it's interesting, in AFA 35, Roelof Peek Botha apparently was tipped off that Pan Am 103 was going to be bombed. He took a different flight with more rigorous security procedures and survived. But the UN administrator for Namibia, formerly German Southwest Africa, and that was a territory that South Africa had maintained hegemony over, and that ultimately was teased away from apartheid South Africa by the United Nations and international pressure, the UN administrator for Namibia was also scheduled to be on Pan Am Flight 103. However, he did not get tipped off, and he died in the explosion. And this Roelof Botha is the grandson of Roelof Peek Botha. Again, one doesn't want to make too much of this yet. When you see someone of this degree of influence within the nascent tech world, and when you see a background stretching back to South Africa's apartheid era, one wants to take note of that. As we've talked about in a number of programs, apartheid South Africa was something of an outgrowth, something of a branch off of the Third Reich. The core of the political power, the core of the power structure in the apartheid regime was something called the National Party. Its core, in turn, was something called the Bruderbond, or Brotherhood in English. And that basically was a fascist organization that dominated the life of apartheid-era South Africa. It was structured along the lines of the German Nazi Party and worked with the German Nazi Party prior to and during World War II. And South Africa remained a repository for elements of the Nazi diaspora in the post-war period, when the Third Reich went underground and was able to perpetuate itself through economic power and also political alliances with various intelligence services and political organizations during the Cold War for the purposes of prosecuting the Cold War. And again, Roelof Botha's grandson, again, a foreign minister of an apartheid-era government, Roelof Botha's grandson is not only an associate of Peter Thiel, but as we're going to see in one of the last articles that we're going to read, was an individual who oversaw, basically, or who stand astride a number of tech companies which pretty much dominate the tech landscape. A Forbes article of February 12th of 2007 has an article by Erica Brown called The Art of Selling Out, and it reads in part, Roelof Botha has been a venture capitalist for 3 years, and he dreams of putting up the early money for a Google-scale success that is adored on Wall Street and feared by rivals. But Botha, 33, is one of the hottest deal makers in Silicon Valley for taking the opposite tack, selling out. Botha joined Sequoia Capital, one of Silicon Valley's elite venture capital firms, in 2003. He had helped run the PayPal online outfit. In February of 2005, two PayPal pals of his started a video weblet called YouTube. Botha put up $8.5 million in Sequoia cash for a 30% stake. In November, Google bought YouTube for $1.65 billion in stock. Sequoia will reap a 65-fold return, catapulting Botha onto the Forbes Midas list of top tech dealmakers. He ranks 23rd. And again, PayPal and YouTube and Facebook and Yelp all are heavily overlapped in terms of individuals and also capital participation. More about Botha's background. Botha was born and bred in South Africa, the grandson of Roelof Peek Botha, a foreign minister from 1977 to 1994 in the apartheid government who supported the release of the imprisoned Nelson Mandela and later served in his government. I would also note that it was in this period that the apartheid-era government of South Africa was closely allied with the most reactionary elements in this country and around the world for the closing phase of the Cold War, and that powerful apartheid-era South African elements, Bruderbond-connected elements, appear to have helped to finance Harkin Energy, one of George W. Bush's energy companies, and itself apparently little more than a money-laundering front. One of the close associates of Roloff Peak Bota, by the way, and again, one doesn't want to make too much of this. One wants to avoid the concept of guilt by association. On the other hand, association by guilt is something one wants to pay attention to. From the Times of Zambia, the obituary for Franz Richter, a game tourism pioneer in South Africa. This is by Chris Barron from December 2nd of 2007. Franz Richter, who was murdered this week in a robbery near his game ranch outside Johannesburg at the age of 80, was one of the pioneers of game tourism in South Africa. Skipping down, as a youth in Romania, he made his way to Germany, and where he promptly was drafted into the Hitler Youth and forced to fight in the German army. And the article goes on to describe how close he was to Roloff Bota, a very good friend of his who was mourning this fellow's murder. And again, one of the good buddies and a fellow who was one of the pioneers of game tourism in South Africa had a background in fascist Romania and fought for the Third Reich. We're going to wrap things up By the way, the concept of the virtual panopticon is something that I'll tag into the description for the record program 718. We're going to conclude the broadcast with an excerpt from a post on linksviewer.com. And that concerns some of the overlap between people who run some of these various tech companies, including Peter Thiel and Roloff Bota. Miguel Heft, who used to be often read in the Mercury, is now a tech writer for the New York Times and had an article on the front page business section on Tuesday about the pals from PayPal and their microcosmic Silicon Valley networking effect and how the small group has hatched and reared some of the most successful companies and exits in the tech world. However, Heft is not yet familiar with our Lynx Viewer tool that does visual networking for Silicon Valley tech and VC networks. And as such, I can't blame him for the illustration from the Times, a network of sorts, but I can credit him with the inspiration to put up some of my own constructed networks of this power cluster that has achieved the kind of success to which we all aspire. It is important to remember that in this network, both Peter Thiel and Reid Hoffman are represented twice, once as an investor with a yellow node and once as a person, board or management team member by a pink or purple node, as noted in the legend at the bottom of the full-size map. In the center of the map, the three-person nodes for Thiel, Hoffman, and Roloff are very central because of their involvement with companies across this entire network. The investor nodes for Hoffman and Thiel create the bottom section of the network because of their investment in companies like Wink, Facebook, Six Apart, and LinkedIn. The bottom left of the image is dominated by PayPal and all of the people linked to it, but the center and top right portions of the map are populated by all of the newer adventures of the PayPal pals, including LinkedIn, Zoom, Facebook, Tagged, Winked, Friendster, and Grassroots Enterprise. The next image focuses on just the newer adventures after PayPal. This network is constructed around the company LinkedIn, the people Roloff Bota, Peter Thiel, and Reid Hoffman, and the investors Reid Hoffman and Peter Thiel. In this network, you can see the powerhouse of company involvement around these individuals. Hoffman, Thiel, and Bota are especially important because these networks only include board members and management team. Even though YouTube's founders are no doubt going to assume more and more central roles in the network if they continue their involvement with new tech adventures, but they were not management team level employees at PayPal. That concludes side two. So think about how much freedom you really have here on this Independence Day vis-a-vis some of these technology developments.
Now, again, from For the Record 718 from July 4th of 2010.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
A number of documents have been declassified by the government relating to the assassination of JFK. I have not paid much attention to that because, frankly, so much has been known about the Kennedy assassination and there have not been a lot of real revelations. Something that underscores how much has been known and yet exemplifies the complete fallacy that is the official version of JFK's assassination is a declassified document that was discussed on the CBS News website of November 17th of 2017. This is by Catherine Watson, W-A-T-S-O-N. Jack Ruby told FBI informant to, quote, watch the fireworks, unquote, the day JFK died. Documents. Jack Ruby, the man who eventually shot Lee Harvey Oswald, told an FBI informant to, quote, watch the fireworks on the day President John F. Kennedy was killed, according to new records the National Archives released Friday. The informant stated that on the morning of the assassination, Ruby contacted him and asked if he would like to watch the fireworks on FBI record dated April 6, 1977, says. He was with Jack Ruby and standing at the corner of the Postal Annex building facing the Texas School Book Depository building at the time of the shooting. Well, obviously, Ruby had advanced knowledge of the attempt that completely disproves the official version of the event. We're going to go back into the archives again, this from For the Record 963, among other programs, also For the Record 108. This is from June 21st of 2017. We're going to listen to a portion of Jack Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission. This is in front of Earl Warren. Warren Commission counsel Arlen Specter, who drew up the magic bullet theory. Specter was Richard Nixon's first choice to become his defense counsel in Watergate. Also Gerald Ford, key Warren Commission member, who became vice president and pardoned Richard Nixon of all crimes he had committed. Leon Jaworski, a member of the board of directors of the MD Anderson Fund, a CIA domestic funding conduit. He was co-counsel for the Texas Court of Inquiry, the Texas body that was initially formed to investigate JFK's assassination. He, of course, became Watergate special prosecutor. Also present here was J. Lee Rankin. He was a key Warren Commission counsel. He was in charge with seeing whether Oswald had intelligence connections and was the liaison between the Warren Commission, the FBI, and the CIA. He was Richard Nixon's first choice to be Watergate special prosecutor. And after he declined, then Nixon tried to get him to be a special reviewer of the Watergate tapes. This is from the Warren Commission interrogation of Jack Ruby from June 7th of 1964. It is related in The Yankee and Cowboy War by Carl Oglesby, and in turn is from Volume 5 of the 26 volumes of Warren Commission Testimony and Exhibits, pages 181 through 212.
Warren, this is another man on my staff, Mr. Specter. Would you mind if he came in? Ruby, is there any way you can get me to Washington? Warren, I beg your pardon? Ruby, is there any way of you getting me to Washington? Warren, I don't know of any. I'll be glad to talk to your counsel about what the situation is, Mr. Ruby, when we get an opportunity to talk. And Oglesby adds in parentheses, Ruby has been intermittently begging a chance to talk to Warren alone. Bear in mind that Ruby did not trust his lawyer, Joe Tonhill, as I've indicated a couple of times. Back to the testimony. Ruby, I don't think I'll get a fair representation with my counsel, Joe Tonhill. I don't think so. I would like to request that I go to Washington and you take all the tests that I have to take. It's very important, Tonhill. Jack, will you tell him why you don't think you will get a fair representation? Ruby, because I have been over this for the longest time to get the lie detector test. Somebody's been holding it back from me. Warren, Mr. Ruby, I might say to you that the lateness of this thing is not due to your counsel. It was our own delay due to the pressures we had on us at the time. And skipping down, Ruby. Gentlemen, unless you get me to Washington, you can't get a fair shake out of me. If you understand my way of talking, you have got to bring me to Washington to get the tests. Do I sound dramatic, off the beam, Warren? No, you were speaking very, very rationally. And I am really quite surprised that you can remember as much as you have remembered up to the present time. You've given it to us in great detail. Ruby. Unless you get me to Washington, and I am not a crackpot, I have all my senses, I don't want to evade any crime I'm guilty of, but, Mr. Moore, have I spoken this way when we talked? Moore. Yes. Ruby. Unless you get me to Washington immediately, I am afraid after what Mr. Tannehill has written there, and skipping ahead, Ruby. Is there any way of getting the polygraph here? Decker, that's Dallas County Sheriff Bill Decker. May I make a suggestion, Jack? Listen, you and I have had a lot of dealings. Do you want my officers removed from the room while you talk to the Warren Commission? Ruby, that wouldn't prove any truth. Decker, these people came several thousand miles to interview you. You have wanted to tell me your story, and I have refused to let you tell me. Now be a man with a bunch of men that have come a long way to give an opportunity to Ruby. I wish the president were here right now. It's a terrible ordeal, I tell you that. And Oglesby adds in parentheses, he subsides for a moment to his pat narrative, then turns back to Decker. Bill, will you do that for me that you asked a minute ago? You said you wanted to leave the room. By the way, I would point out that Decker had refused to let Ruby testify to him alone. Continuing. Decker. I will have everyone leave the room, including myself, if you want to talk about it. You name it, and out we will go. Ruby. All right. Decker. You want all of us outside? Ruby. Yes. Decker. I will leave Tannehill and Moore. I am not going to have Joe leave. Joe, of course, is Joe Tannehill, Ruby's lawyer, whom he does not trust. Ruby. If you're not going to have Joe leave, Decker, Moore, his body's responsible to you. His body is responsible to you. Bill. That's Ruby. Bill, I am not accomplishing anything if they are here and Joe Tannehill is here. You asked me anybody I wanted out. Decker. Jack, this is your attorney. That is your lawyer. Ruby. He is not my lawyer. And then Oglesby adds in parentheses that Decker and law enforcement officers leave the room. Ruby adds, gentlemen, if you want to hear any further testimony, you will have to get me to Washington, because it has something to do with you, Chief Warren. Do I sound sober enough to tell you this, Warren? Yes, go right ahead, Ruby. I want to tell the truth, and I can't tell it here. I can't tell it here. Does that make sense to you, Warren? Well, let's not talk about sense. But I really can't see why you can't tell this commission, Ruby. But this isn't the place for me to tell what I want to tell. Moore. The commission is looking into the entire matter, and you are part of it. Should be. Ruby. Chief Warren, your life is in danger in this city. Do you know that? Warren. No, I don't know that. If that's the thing that you don't want to talk about, you can tell me, if you wish, when this is all over, just between you and me, Ruby. No, I would like to talk to you in private, Warren. You may do that when you finish your story, you may tell me that phase of it. Ruby, I bet you haven't had a witness like me in your whole investigation. Is that correct? Warren, there are many witnesses whose memory has not been as good as yours. I tell you that honestly. Ruby, my reluctance to talk. You haven't had any witness in telling the story in finding so many problems. Warren, you have a greater problem than any witness we've had. Ruby, I have a lot of reasons for having those problems. Warren, I know that. And we want to respect your rights, whatever they may be. And I only want to hear what you are willing to tell us, because I realize that you still have a great problem before you, and I am not trying to press you. Ruby, when are you going back to Washington? Warren, I'm going back shortly after we finish this hearing. I'm going to have some lunch. Ruby, can I make a statement? Warren, yes. Ruby, if you request me to go back to Washington with you right now, that couldn't be done, could it? Warren, no, it could not be done. It could not be done. There are a good many things involved in that, Mr. Ruby. Ruby, what are they? Warren, well, the public attention that it would attract and the people who would be around. We have no place for you to be safe when we take you out, and we're not law enforcement officers, and it isn't our responsibility to go into anything of that kind. And certainly it couldn't be done on a moment's notice this way. Ruby, gentlemen, my life is in danger here. Not with my guilty plea of execution, Oglesby adds, i.e. not because of killing Oswald. Do I sound sober enough to you as I say this, Warren? You do. You sound entirely sober. Ruby, from the moment I started my testimony, have I sounded as though, with the exception of becoming emotional, haven't I sounded as though I make sense what I was talking about? Warren, you have indeed. I understand everything you have said. If I haven't, it's my fault. Ruby, then I follow this up. I may not live tomorrow to give any further testimony. The reason why I add this to this, since you assure me that I've been speaking sense by then, I might be speaking sense by following what I've said, and the only thing I want to get out to the public, and I can't say it here, is with authenticity, with sincerity of the truth of everything, and why my act was committed. But it can't be said here. It can be said. It's got to be said amongst people of the highest authority that would give me the benefit of the doubt, and following that, immediately give me the lie detector test after I do make the statement. Chairman Warren, if you felt that your life was in danger at the moment, how would you feel? Wouldn't you be reluctant to go on speaking, even though you request me to do so, Warren? I think I might have some reluctance if I was in your position. Yes, I think I would. I think I would figure it out very carefully as to whether it would endanger me or not. If you think that anything that I am doing or anything that I am asking you is endangering you in any way, shape, or form, I want you to feel absolutely free to say that the interview is over. Ruby, what happens then? I didn't accomplish anything. Warren, no, nothing's been accomplished. Ruby, well, then you won't follow up with anything further? Warren, there wouldn't be anything to follow up if you hadn't completed your statement. Ruby, you said you have the power to do what you want to do. Is that correct, Warren? Exactly. Ruby, without any limitations? Warren, within the purview of the executive order which established the commission. Ruby, But you don't have a right to take a prisoner back with you when you want to, Warren. No. We have the power to subpoena witnesses to Washington if we want to do it. But we've taken the testimony of 200 or 300 people, I would imagine, here in Dallas, without going to Washington, Ruby. Yes, but those people aren't Jack Ruby, Warren. No, they weren't. Ruby, they weren't. Warren. Now, I want you to feel that we are not here to take any advantage of you, because I know that you were in a delicate position, and unless you had indicated not only through your lawyers, but also through your sister, who wrote a letter addressed either to me or to Mr. Rankin, saying that you wanted to testify before the commission, unless she had told us that, I wouldn't have bothered you, Ruby. The thing is, that with your power that you have, Chief Justice Warren, and all these gentlemen, too much time has gone by for me to give you any benefit of what I may say now. And, still later, the Rankin here, by the way, is J. Lee Rankin of Warren Commission Counsel. Rankin, it isn't entirely clear how you feel that your family and you yourself are threatened by your killing what, beginning again... It isn't entirely clear how you feel that your family and you yourself are threatened by your telling what you have to the commission. How do you come to the conclusion that they might be killed? Will you tell us a little bit more about that if you can, Ruby? Well, assuming that, as I stated before, some persons are accusing me, falsely, of being part of the plot, naturally... In all the time from over 6 months ago, my family has been so interested in helping me, Rankin. By that you mean a party to the plot of Oswald, Ruby? That I was a party to a plot to silence Oswald. And skipping down, one. Mr. Ruby, I think you are entitled to a statement to this effect, because you have been frank with us and have told us your story. I think I can say to you that there has been no witness before this commission out of the hundreds we have questioned who has claimed to have any personal knowledge that you were a party to any conspiracy to kill our president, Ruby. Yes, but you don't know this area here, Warren. Well, I will make this additional statement to you, that if any witness should testify before the commission that you were, to their knowledge, a party to any conspiracy to assassinate the president, I assure you that we will give you the opportunity to deny it and to take any tests that you may desire to so disprove it. Skipping down. Ruby. And I wish that our beloved president, Lyndon Johnson, would have delved deeper into the situation, hear me, not to accept just circumstantial facts about my guilt or innocence, and would have questioned to find out the truth about me before he relinquished certain powers to these certain people. Consequently, a whole new form of government is going to take over our country, and I know I won't live to see you another time. Do I sound sort of screwy in telling you these things, Warren? No, I think that is what you believe, or you wouldn't tell it under oath. Ruby, but it is a very serious situation. I guess it's too late to stop it, isn't it? And skipping down. Next, you'll hear from Gerald Ford, a Warren Commission member, who, as I've said a couple of times, was already, was named by Richard Nixon to replace Spiro Agnew as vice president. Later, he succeeded Nixon as president and pardoned Nixon of all crimes that he may have committed. Ford, are there any questions that ought to be asked to help clarify the situation that you described? Ruby, there is only one thing. If you don't take me to Washington tonight to give me a chance to prove to the president that I am not guilty, then you will see the most tragic, thing that will ever happen. And still later, Ruby. Now maybe something can be saved. It may not be too late, whatever happens, if our president, Lyndon Johnson, knew the truth from me. But if I am eliminated, there won't be any way of knowing. Right now, When I leave your presence now, I am the only one that can bring out the truth to our president who believes in righteousness and justice. But he's been told, I am certain, that I was part of a plot to assassinate the president.
I know, your hands are tied, you're helpless, Warren. Mr. Ruby, I think I can say this to you, that if he has been told any such thing, there is no indication of any kind that he believes it. Ruby,
I am sorry, Chief Justice Warren. I thought I would be very effective in telling you what I have said here. But in all fairness to everyone, maybe all I want to do is beg that if they found out I was telling the truth, maybe they can succeed in what their motives are, but maybe my people won't be tortured and mutilated.
And skipping down, Warren. Well, you may be sure that my president and his whole commission will do anything that is necessary to see that your people are not tortured. Ruby,
no.
Warren,
you may be sure of that.
Ruby, no.
The only way you can do it is if he knows the truth, that I'm telling the truth, and why I was down in that basement Sunday morning, and maybe some sense of decency will come out, and they can still fulfill their plan, as I stated before, without my people going through torture and mutilation.
Warren, the president will know everything that you have said. Everything that you have said.
Ruby, but I won't be around, Chief Justice. I won't be around to verify those things that you were going to tell the president.
Tannehill, who never left the room. Who do you think is going to eliminate you, Jack?
Ruby, I have been used for a purpose, and there will be a certain tragic occurrence happening if you don't take my testimony and somehow vindicate me so my people don't suffer because of what I've done.
Ruby, but we have taken your testimony. We have it here. It will be in permanent form for the President of the United States and for the Congress of the United States and for the courts of the United States and for the people of the entire world. It is there. It will be recorded for all to see. That is the purpose of our coming here today. We feel that you're entitled to have your story told.
Ruby,
you have lost me, though. You have lost me, Chief Justice Warren.
Warren, lost you?
In what sense?
Ruby,
I won't be around for you to come and question again,
Warren.
Well, it is very hard for me to believe that. I am sure that everybody would want to protect you to the very limit,
Ruby.
All I want is a lie detector test, and you refuse to give it to me. Because as it stands now in the truth serum and any other pentothal, how do you pronounce it, whatever it is, and they will not give it to me because I want to tell the truth, and then I want to leave this world.
And skipping ahead still further, Ruby,
how are we going to communicate and so on,
Warren?
We will communicate directly with you,
Ruby.
You have a lost cause, Earl Warren. You don't stand a chance. They feel about you like they do about me, Chief Justice Warren. I shouldn't hurt your feelings in telling you that.
And in that discussion, younger listeners may wonder about what Jack Ruby was alluding to when he said they feel the same way about you, Chief Justice Warren, as they do about me. Earl Warren and the Warren Court were major targets of the John Birch Society and the American Radical Right. One of the founders of the John Birch Society was Fred Koch, the father of Charles and David Koch, the Republican money men. And in the book Dark Money by Jane Mayer, copyright 2016, published in soft cover by Anchor Books, there is a note about Fred Koch's behavior after the JFK assassination. The John Birch Society had been accusing JFK of being a communist, and then, as Mayer notes, quote, in a hasty turnabout soon after the assassination, Fred Koch took out full-page ads in the New York Times and the Washington Post mourning JFK. the ads advanced the conspiracy theory that JFK's assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, had acted as part of a communist plot. The communists wouldn't rest on this success, unquote, the ads warned. That places Fred Koch basically at the core of what Professor Peter Dale Scott has called the level one cover-up. Basically, it was the commies that did it. We will have more to say about many things because there has been much going on. However, this concludes For the Record program number 994. What was old is new again. This is being recorded on January 30th of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.